This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Patrick Murphy has worked in the criminal and juvenile justice systems for more than 30 years. As public guardian in Cook County, Illinois, which includes the Chicago metropolitan area, he represents abused and neglected children, as well as senile or disabled elderly people. His new book, Wasted: The Plight of America's Unwanted Children, describes the child welfare system and how it often fails our nation's most disadvantaged kids. Patrick Murphy writes that when he started his job in the 60s, Cook County Juvenile Court handled fewer than 2,000 children. Today, more than 40,000 abused and neglected kids are in the custody of the Cook County courts. 90% of these children are born to women on welfare, and at least 80% have no involved father. Murphy argues that the child welfare system today tends to see the parents of abused children as the victims of poverty, and in its focus on rehabilitating parents and preserving the family, the system loses track of the true victims, the children. This policy of family preservation evolved as a response to the failures of the child welfare system in the past, when abused and unwanted children were shunted from one state institution to the next. I asked Patrick Murphy to describe one such child, Bill, who was his first case as public guardian.
Bill was a kid that was abandoned in the Skid Row section of Chicago, and he came into our system. We gave him a name because no one really knew his name, and an age, and the age turned out to be the wrong age, and an IQ test, which was based upon the erroneous age, and they said he was retarded. He's a very, very dysfunctional young man. Today he's 40. But he was never retarded, but he was locked up in a number of facilities for retarded and then for mentally ill, and he spent 3 years in the local detention facility for delinquents. So pretty much his life was messed up by us and was probably messed up by his parents before he ever came into the system. I mean, he was abandoned at age 5.
Now, why did you start with him, other than the fact that you were making a parallel between then and now?
He was the first. I had been a prosecutor and criminal defense lawyer and also a Peace Corps volunteer before I got into this in my early 30s. And he was the first kid I ever represented. And he brought out a lot of the issues which were going on in those days. That is horrible residential care for kids, kids being taken from parents. Sometimes his only crime was poverty, although he didn't fall in that category. And I liked the kid, and I still like him, and I still have a relationship with him, and I suppose for that reason I wanted to talk about him.
Well, he got shunted around from home, residential home, to foster care, to here and there. Is a child entering the child welfare system now likely to get the same kind of chaotic moving around?
Not as much as in those days. Relative care has stepped in, so a lot of grannies and aunts and uncles are now taking care of these kids, so they aren't being moved around quite as much as they used to be. But some kids are still being moved around, and some kids are still in not all that hot residential care, although for the most part, residential care is a lot better. You know, we used to call orphanages, is a lot better than it used to be.
Well, you write that one of the main principles driving the child welfare system right now, perhaps driving it in the wrong direction, is family preservation. And you write about one specific case that falls under the heading of animal family preservation. I'd like you to describe the situation your friend, the dog catcher, presented to you.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, family preservation is something that came about in the 1980s, actually the 1980 Adoption Assistance Act passed by Congress, which mandated that when states got federal funds, as we all do, they had to make actually overly heroic efforts to keep families together, or once the kids were taken out, to put them back in with the families. And actually, I testified on 3 occasions before congressional committees in favor of this legislation and wrote a book back in the 70s where I championed this legislation. So I was one of its early proponents, and I still think, by the way, it's an excellent idea that has to a large part gone wrong. And one of the cases, and it's actually, in terms of the cases I cite in the book and in terms of the cases I've seen, it's not one of the more serious ones, although it's a little humorous. And in this arena, by the way, if you don't have a sense of humor, you're going to burn out and go away in a year or two. What happened was that back in the 70s, this man and his wife were living in a place with dogs and cats and parrots and mongoose. I mean, just about every animal you can think of. and the police had to come, and ultimately the home had to be torn down. It was in such bad condition, and the children were taken out. That's the background. Back in the early 90s, I got a call from Animal Control Expedite, or whatever they're called, the dog catcher. And he said he had to see me, and I said, we don't take care of dogs, we take care of kids. But anyway, he came by, and he assaulted me, basically, and said, listen, I was at this home, the same home that we're talking about, only it was in the 90s now, and they had to break in because the smell was so terrible. The neighbors complained. There were something like 24 dogs in the place, and the father, the husband, was in the corner with his leg being eaten away from gangrene, and the boy, who was about 10 or 11, was covered with feces, and he said it was one of the worst, most inhumane situations ever seen. The windows were locked. It was in August in hot, sultry, humid Chicago. So he said they got the dogs out of this inhumane situation, but he called the Department of Children and Family Services with respect to the child, and they came in and said, well, no problem. All the mother needs is some family preservation funds and a homemaker and a social worker, and she'll be all right. So he called outraged about this, and of course we got involved, and the woman was a very, very sick woman who there was no way that this woman could ever, ever take care of that child. And then we had another case similar to that where a woman with the IQ of a six-year-old had a baby who was 6 months old. She was in her 20s. And she had to take the kid to the hospital because he was failing to thrive. The hospital refused to give the child back to the woman because she was so disabled. The Department of Children and Family Services came by and said, no, there's no problem. We've been giving her family preservation for 6 months. They still refused to do it, and then they brought it to court. When we looked at it, we looked at the child welfare report. Even their own report said that the home, after the homemaker had been in it, the housekeeper had been in there, there was debris all over. There was several dogs, cats, a parrot, and a monkey. And you say to yourself, a monkey in Chicago in this home and the six-month-old? Well, you know, maybe that's the only reason the kid survived that long. But they were intent on trying to keep this family together. It wasn't a family. And again, you can feel sorry for this woman, as we should, and she is to be pitied and she is to be assisted, but she is not to be given a child to raise. She can't do it.
Well, explain this to me, why family services would send children, and we hear about these cases all the time, send children back to parents who are obviously mentally or emotionally impaired.
Well, you know, it comes down to various reasons. I mean, number one, once you're in this system, as I have been for almost 30 years now, you understand that even a marginal family is better than the state for raising a child. The state doesn't do a good job. We don't have the resources. And most children have bonded to even the worst parents. So that when you break the bond, it creates all kinds of problems that the kid will never overcome. Now, sometimes, by the way, it's major surgery, and you have to break that bond. And the kid will have problems, but keeping the kid with the parent will create greater problems. So that there are legitimate reasons for trying to keep families together. And what has happened is that within the child welfare system, they have taken this legitimate idea and thrown in a lot of leftover bogus philosophy from the 60s where the poor are victims. Now, most of the people we deal with are very poor, underclass people who are there but for the grace of God go I type of people, so that we feel sorry for them. And then what happens, we combine all this, and then sooner or later, before long, what had happened was that the parents became the ultimate victims, not the child. The parent was a victim of an uncaring society, of poverty, of racism, of classism. And they wouldn't have done this if not for that. So hence, we have to bend over backwards to help this parent because we were the ones who shafted the parent in the first place. So it's kind of this sloppy thinking going on. And because of that, there was a big push in the late 80s and early 90s, and still today in many quarters, to keep families together or to push them back together. And it somehow helps our middle class mentality and minds and philosophy, but it does nothing for the child.
It seems as if the system treats all parents the same, the evil parents who perpetuate this horrific abuse and the kind of unintentionally neglectful parents who are in trouble and don't have enough money and are in a bad spot in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. There are you know, you get cases of the father who has, you know, I'll give an example. One time I was trying to get legislation passed that would say you cannot provide family preservation funds to people who have sexually abused their kids, for instance, until such time as the case had come to court and the judge looked at it. You couldn't do it without a judicial hearing. And I was talking to a group of social workers about this, and one raised her hand and said, but what about the father who sexually abuses his daughter? Do you really want to delay him getting therapy until such time as he can get to court? And I said, is that before or after we castrate him? And of course, they all looked at me like I was the thug that I am, I suppose. But, I mean, the point is that there are some crimes or some things that parents do to their children that are so serious, we should get right beyond rehabilitation. There's no rehabilitation for someone who tortures his child or murders another child when you come to a sibling or who has sex with a child. You know, we've got to move and say, hey, wait, this man should be prosecuted. But what you see is, you know, and it's, I've been saying this for years, and it's a cliche, but if you go down the block and have sex with the kid down the block or torture the kid down the block, you're going to do 30 years. If you do it to your own kid, you'll get a social worker and a homemaker. And whereas that is somewhat of an embellishment, I have seen it actually happen too often, or variations on the theme happen too often, not to know that it is inaccurate. And then you'll get the mom coming in who's got four kids. She's 22. She has no high school education. She had her first child at 14. She was encouraged to have children by a culture that says it's okay to have kids. None of the fathers hung around. She's done a Herculean job of raising the kids. She wakes up at 22, looks out the window, gets depressed, and says, my life is over, as indeed it is. Then she turns to drugs. Her drug supplier becomes her paramour and ultimately abuses her and the kids. You know, this type of woman should get services and should get help, albeit you don't extend it on forever and ever. And there are a lot of things we've got to change about the culture. But we'll treat her the same way we will the torturer or the person who just walks out on the kids and leaves them alone for weeks while she or he is out doing drugs or something. And you can't treat them the same.
Every few months, there's some new horrendous headline about a child who has died in foster care or in their home, despite the fact that caseworkers were visiting and monitoring the family. How do they actually inspect children and inspect a home that they would miss this?
I think that over the past couple of decades, the parent has been perceived as the true victim of child abuse in many, many quarters. So that what the worker is doing is concentrating on the parent. I'm involved in two cases right now where children died, in one case, a six-month-old starved to death while the worker was going in every two or three weeks. And obviously he was communicating and dealing with the parents and not really looking at the child. In another case, a three-and-a-half-year-old girl weighed 18 pounds, and the mother ultimately poured scalding water over her vagina and anus, killing her and just burning her horribly. But there were like 40 or 45 different instances of marks and scars on her body, which according to the medical examiner occurred in the 2 or 3 months prior to that time. Now, in that time, family preservation had been in the home up to 4 and 5 times a week, but apparently never looked at the child and just dealt with the mom. In fact, was taking her to lunch. They were providing a housekeeper for her, buying her dressers and things like that. Now, in both these cases, were involved in lawsuits against the private agencies.
It sounds as if this were incompetence,
It's really much more than incompetence. If it was just incompetence, you could wipe it away. What it is it is the way. Now, it is to a degree incompetence. Obviously, in these cases, they should have caught it. But it's also a philosophy that the child belongs to the parent. You know, you can go back to the last century. The child's the property of the parent. Now it's not phrased that way. That's politically incorrect. But that these folks are poor. These folks are minority. These folks have been put upon. These folks never had a chance in life. And we're talking about the parents here. Now, all of that, by the way, is true in most cases. But the focus has to be on the child. Otherwise, you're leaving a child in a situation where he or she has been tortured in one way or another. And that's what we have to protect against.
I'm talking with Patrick Murphy. He's public guardian of Cook County, Illinois, where he represents abused and neglected children, also elderly and senile people. His new book about the child welfare system is Wasted, The Plight of America's Unwanted Children. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Patrick Murphy, public guardian of Cook County, Illinois. We're talking about how our child welfare system fails many abused and neglected children. You write that there's too much lawyering and due process and judging going on in the child welfare system, also in the juvenile justice.
By the way, I am a lawyer. I practiced law for 33 years in every court from the U.S. Supreme Court on down, so I'm not knocking lawyers when I say that.
What should take their place? Why are the courts not the right vehicle to take on child abuse and neglect?
Well, there's two aspects to the question. The first is looking at it from the point of view of what goes on today, and that is that much of what we do is, you know, we bring in judges and lawyers and court reporters and public defenders and state's attorneys, and we sit around 25, 26, 27-year-old kids, that's not me, who, you know, may be very motivated and very dedicated, but we're dealing with highly complex societal, familial issues. And we're no better able to do it, in fact, in many ways less able to do it than, say, a real social worker with a real master's degree. Now, we provide due process to the families, so we can't take a kid without a judicial hearing. But so many cases, I think, can be resolved in the community without us getting involved. The case of the mother who turns the drugs has no involved father and three or four kids. Normally, she recognizes that she's not doing her kids a favor. And it seems to me that this is a situation where the social workers bring in the grandmother, the aunts, the extended family. They sit around the table and they all talk to her and say, listen, why don't you agree to give your kids to grandma? Grandma will receive the money. You're going to get services. We're going to send you to a drug rehab center. We're going to try to work with you for the next 6 or 8 months. Now, you have a right to a lawyer. You have a right to go to court. You have a right to fight us. And by the way, in 6 or 8 months, if you don't turn it around, we're probably going to end up in court anyway. But this is your chance. And it can be done, you know, by looking the woman in the eye. She can talk to you, you can talk to her. If there's an involved father around, you can say, let's get him down here, let's talk. It's a much more human way of handling things. It's much cheaper, and it's much better for the parent, for everybody.
So this would prevent those cases in which kids are taken away, and while a woman waits for a court date, the kids sleep in some social worker's office in some federal building because there's no place for them to go to a foster home.
Or move from foster home to foster home while the mom doesn't get visits. It's all done informally. The kid's with a grandma or an aunt, or even maybe there isn't a grandma or aunt that's with a foster parent that's not a relative, but at least the mom is set up to visit. And everything can work informally without, you know, lawyers and judges are for major surgery. You know, I went to law school 3 years at Northwestern here. They didn't teach me anything about child welfare. They didn't teach me anything about children. They taught you how to get into a conflict. It was a true conflict, and try to do something about it. We create conflicts in the child welfare system when we could avoid the conflict by letting it be handled in the community by real master degree social workers, people whose expertise it is to deal with this kind of issue.
Do we need more orphanages?
I think it's a complex issue. As I point out in the book, one time the ACLU lawyer got up in court and said, orphanages kill people, they ruin people, we should do away with them. And I point out, yeah, my dad spent 3 years in one. Of course, he went wrong someplace because of his 8 kids that he sired, and all of them got advanced degrees. 4 of us became lawyers. So maybe the orphanage did follow him up a little bit. Is a family better than an orphanage? Absolutely. But for some kids, you have no option, particularly for adolescent kids. Foster care frequently isn't good for them. Adolescent kids relate more to their peers than their parents. I mean, my own son recently told me that I didn't know everything. So for adolescents, I think residential care can be a lifesaver. Right now, I see too many kids living on the streets. And also for some younger kids who go through 4 or 5 foster homes, these kids come into the system very, very dysfunctional. They've been through a lot. Their parents have rejected them, sometimes beaten them. They get in foster care and they test the foster parent, test them, and the foster parent gives up. And then they go to another home. And now their self-esteem is even lower. They've been rejected twice. And this course goes on until they have nothing left in them. So residential care for younger kids until they get stabilized, so that they can get back into the system or go home is also a good idea. It shouldn't be more than a year or two for the younger kids, and hopefully less than that. But sometimes it's absolutely necessary. You've got to stabilize these kids, and foster homes don't have the expertise or the patience to do it.
Well, child welfare, the system is protected by confidentiality laws, which I think you argue in some ways help perpetuate the incompetence.
Yeah, the confidentiality laws were put in place to protect the families. They exist today not to protect incompetence. They exist today to protect the system from the public, because if the public knew the philosophy of the system, knew what we did, there would be an outcry for change. There's no outcry for change because no one knows how stupid the system is. I would do away with the laws of confidentiality. I would give the media unfettered access to every case file of any kid who was harmed while he or she was in the system or serviced by the system, completely. And the reporter should have access to every juvenile courtroom and have access to most files. The only way the system is ever going to be reformed is if the public understands exactly what's going on inside it.
I want to really thank you for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Patrick Murphy is the public guardian for Cook County, Illinois. His new book is Wasted, The Plight of America's Unwanted Children. This is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.